Good afternoon, brethren. On a very beautiful Sabbath day. We had just about the best weather I suppose you could have in Jerusalem. It was just almost like spring over there most of the time. And we did hear about your little ice storm that you had here, and that made us feel bad, but there's nothing we could do about it. But it sure is nice to have the sunshine and the beautiful weather. That always makes everything a little easier, and especially the way we were traveling around in Jerusalem. We did appreciate the wonderful weather that God did give us and help us to do what we wanted to do. While we were over in Jerusalem, we did do one television program. That's all we really had time to do, because we were busy traveling around to two different conferences while we were over there. But I do believe that this Jerusalem trip certainly could prove to be the most important one we have had. It could be that way. Dr. Mazar spoke at the first conference and did a very good job and had some impressive slides there about the dig, which has been stopped, and just almost nothing is happening there at all. And she talked about how she'd like to continue that, and she feels like there's a lot more to be uncovered. There were four other members on her panel, and all of them did refer back to her and said that what she's doing, they felt like could really help to get people's Jews to look to Jerusalem. And of course, they wanted them to think about Jerusalem as one city that they all loved and were willing to fight for and continue to support in every way. And even the mayor, who was actually introducing the panel, mentioned her as well. So she is quite well known in Jerusalem, but at this time, she has been unable to get any support to continue the dig, which seems strange, the way people support it, and they're all excited about it, and yet nobody wants to support it, and a lot of it's because of the economic problems that are going on around the world. Of course, most of the donations came from the states, and they have just about dried up altogether. But we did have dinner with her and wanted to talk to her more about the dig and see if there was anything we could do to help. And we wanted to find out, like, how much the Shalem Center was able to give her in sponsoring that and what kind of dollars she was talking about. And we did discover that they, I guess to get this whole dig started, they gave like $500,000. And that's quite a lot of money, but still, it's not an overwhelming amount of money for something like this. And we did begin to talk to her some about, does she think, could she get the dig started again, maybe if we were able to help her, not only with some donations, but also with some more students than what we've had in the past. And I do believe we have some other offices around the world that could help support it quite a lot with some of their surplus funds. But we wanted to see if she would be interested in something like that, because it does seem strange to us that all of a sudden everything would be cut off and there's just no support at all, even though she's speaking before a lot of influential people and really quite a few wealthy people. Still, there was nobody, as far as we know, that offered, certainly not while we were there, offered to help her start the dig again. So we talked to her quite a lot about that, and then my son followed up and talked to her some more, and she was wondering if maybe we could possibly bypass the tunnel. There might be a few problems there, and we said no. If we were involved in it, we certainly want to get involved in everything that we've been doing. And also, I'll just read here something that we've written down. After she asked about the prospect of planning for a dig in the summer of 2010, we responded with this question: well, do you think the obstacles blocking the way for us to start this summer would be any smaller next summer? She said she didn't know, and then asked me what I thought, and I think the longer we wait, the more difficult it will be. I think that's easy for you to understand, for us to understand, when you see what's going on in the Middle East. And I mean, it is just raging with fulfilled prophecy in that area, that part of the world. Just the February 1st, 3rd, 5th, and 9th, here's what happened. Dr. Mazar called the City of David people to tell them she might have a possible sponsor for another phase, referring to us. The director was out of town the rest of the week. February 3rd, at Ophir's bar mitzvah, that's her son, her 13-year-old son's bar mitzvah, we went to that. Numerous archaeologists talk about how little funding there is for excavations because of the economic crisis. I mean, she had archaeologists there. One of them was her first cousin. And there just doesn't seem to be any funds available to renew that dig. February the 5th, Dr. Mazar walked the excavation site with the City of David people to tell them what she is proposing. February 9th, Dr. Mazar will meet with the director of the City of David on Monday to see if the prospect of doing a dig this summer is even possible. So she's seeing what is possible, and we are interested in trying to get the dig going again for various reasons, but we find it absolutely, well, puzzling, in a positive way, I think, why the dig has stopped. And maybe there is a good reason for that. We still have not tapped into our construction loan, and God's people have been very enthusiastic in supporting this work and the house for God. And I hope we'll all remember what we're doing and all of these projects we have going on as the holy days get very close. But I think we could be on the verge of something truly important to finish God's work. I think it could be stunning in many ways. Mr. Armstrong, before he would get involved in that archaeology project, on a level that we're now talking about getting involved in it, only I think it would be considerably less money that we would have to donate, but he wanted to come back to Pasadena and think about it for a couple of weeks anyhow and see if he thought God was really opening a door. And we told Dr. Mazar we wanted to do the same thing. We wanted to come back and we wanted to think about it and wanted her to pursue everything she could, and that we'd let her know in 2 weeks if we'd go ahead, if we can, in fact, get approval to do so. She told me something when we had dinner with her that I'd never heard before. She said that Dr. Benjamin Mazar, her grandfather, was at one time also was having trouble getting funds. And he didn't know what to do, and he was upset about it. And apparently, Mr. Armstrong had been making a few overtures in that direction. And so his wife kept saying to him, well, what about this Armstrong guy? And he said, oh, no, I don't want to get involved with him. Because this was a Christian from the States, and he didn't want a part of that. So finally, though, nothing happened, so he did say, okay, well, I'll talk to him. So he did talk to Mr. Armstrong, and I think you know the rest is history, as they say. And it may be, brethren, that God is about to perform another miracle like he did before for us at this time, because we are the ones, really, who have the key to that dig and a lot more from all that we can understand from the Scriptures. I think there could be two real solid advantages for us going ahead with this dig if we can do that, and I believe we can. But this prestigious dig, I think, well, you have to remember, we're foreigners when we're over in Israel, and this dig could certainly give us the dignity and prestige and whatever else we might need, the stature, perhaps, to be able to do our God's work of proclaiming his message to the cities of Judah. And we do have that job to do. It's going to pave the way for that to be fulfilled somehow. Mr. Armstrong knew it, we know it, but we still don't see how it's going to happen. Now, if we were to get more involved and involved on this level, you could see how that could sort of catapult us into a totally different area as far as maybe getting something done over there. You can read Isaiah 40, and if I have time, I might come back later and read it, but it does tell us we are to go to the cities of Judah. You say to the cities of Judah, doesn't talk about the archaeological dig there, but I think it does certainly in Isaiah 22. But God says, I want you to proclaim to the cities of Judah, behold your God. And that's the only hope the cities of Judah or anybody else has in this end time. So we're going to have stature to be able to do God's work, and we're also going to be paving the way, I think, for proclaiming this message to the cities of Judah, and it may even have something to do with helping us to prepare for the place of safety. But Jesus Christ is about to return to this earth. God is about to return. Behold your God. Now, if you see what's going on in the Middle East, you have to believe that's the only hope this world has. Behold your God. Jesus Christ really is about ready to return to this earth. How else are we going to save humanity alive? Notice Isaiah 22 and verse 20. It's not always easy to proclaim this message. You know, Jeremiah talks about these hostile looks and these great critics we're going to have and persecutors we're going to have in this end time. Verse 20 of Isaiah 22. And it shall come to pass in that day that I will call my servant Eliakim, the son of Hilkiah, and I will clothe him with your robe and strengthen him with your girdle, and I will commit your government into his hand, and he shall be a father to the inhabitants of Jerusalem and to the house of Judah. And the key of the house of David, the key of the house of David, that's more than just the dig, of course, but I absolutely believe it includes the dig. The key of the house of David will I lay upon his shoulder, so he shall open and none shall shut, and he shall shut and none shall open. So there's only going to be an Eliakim in this end time that's going to have the key to open up that house of David. The donations have dried up. Could it be, brethren, could it be that God has a hand in that because there's only an Eliakim that has the key that's going to unlock what needs to be unlocked just before Christ returns to this earth? Is it because, has it been stopped because only Eliakim has that key? Well, that's what God says. And there's going to have to be a door that's unlocked. It's the key of the house of David. And who knows what mysteries are there, what we might uncover, what we might discover in that day. And maybe it's very important that we be in a different position than we have been in the past. It does take faith to walk through God's open door. If God opens the door, first of all, we have to have the faith to know if it really is being opened by God. Is God really opening that door? Well, we want to know. That's why we wanted 2 weeks to take this more to God and try to determine that as much as we can. But if we do then determine that it is an open door, it takes even more faith to walk through that door that Christ is leading us through. It is, after all, a matter of following Christ through the open door. Now, that's not always an easy thing to do. We certainly understand that, but I'll tell you this, Christ thinks big. And it's not always easy to think like Christ thinks. It isn't Eliakim doing anything, it's just except following through on what God says must be done. But he says there will be a man that will be there that will have the key that will unlock the house of David, including the palace of David. I think it's pretty obvious. But it does take faith, brethren, to see those open doors and then to walk through them. And that takes faith. That takes faith from you and from me and from everybody if we're going to do the job. The faith to see when God is opening a door and just walk through it and know everything is just as secure as can be. And you can be sure there will be times when that door will seem like quite an undertaking, quite a challenge for God's people to walk through. There was a lot happening while we were over in the Middle East, and they talked a lot about Hamas, and I did mention about a little about January the 16th before we even left. But I thought it was kind of interesting that on January the 16th is the day that Israel announced a unilateral withdrawal from Gaza. Another defeat. Hamas won because Israel didn't destroy them. Hamas is going to get stronger and Israel is going to get weaker. And I just thought it was interesting that on the 17th, the Israeli cabinet officially approved that unilateral withdrawal. And of course, that's the day that the Laodiceans began their downfall. Spiritual Israel began to fall on that day. And I thought that was kind of interesting. And that's documented. You can check that with I've just had people send me documents because I thought it was kind of interesting. But a lot is happening, brethren, and we have to understand how very serious it is. Thomas Friedman was one of the men that spoke at one of those conferences, and he says the economic, that financial crisis has the potential to get a lot worse, and it could be terrifying. And it is going to be terrifying. I can tell you that by the authority of God, it is going to be terrifying. And they're still groping around in the dark trying to figure out what to do. And we have people making decisions, businesses' decisions about spending billions and even trillions of dollars. And some of them have never even made a real business decision in all of their lives. That's pretty dicey, if you ask me. That's a big problem. Mr. Benjamin Netanyahu looks like he might be the next prime minister of Israel, but in Israel you never know for sure. But he said, I'll tell you that what is happening in Iran and this with their nuclear power is far, far outranks the financial crisis you see going on in this world. And it does. It does, and it is going to be the trigger that begins to start World War III and leave this earth in just one big cemetery. And that's what this is all about, really, brethren. But you can see why God wants us to get a message out and say to people who can see that, and say, behold, your God is coming. And it's extremely imminent. You can read Daniel 11, 40, 41. We talk about that all the time. And let's take a look today at where we are in Bible prophecy. Because, you know, brethren, there's all these terrible things happening. And at the same time, if this deal works out about the archaeological dig, it just seems to me that it could be something that could really be very stunning and wonderful. Because God is always there with His work, and He's always trying to tell them what He wants to do and what is going to happen. But the people in this world are not prone to listen to what God says, and certainly not the intelligentsia. And that's what we were in the midst of in both of those conferences. Here's what Netanyahu said. He said, what is not reversible is the acquisition of nuclear weapons by a fanatic, radical regime, he said. We've never had, since the dawn of the nuclear age, nuclear weapons in the hands of such a fanatical regime. And that's putting it rather nicely. We have had two wars with Iranian proxies in 2 years, and Persia has now two bases on the eastern Mediterranean. That is, at both ends of Israel. That's what he's talking about. He said, referring to the recent fighting in Gaza against Hamas and Israel's 2006 war with Hezbollah in Lebanon. Soon they'll have control of the West Bank as well, or at least a good portion of it. But the Shiite Muslims have their own version of the Messianic return, like Judaism and Christianity. The more devout Islamic believers pray toward Jem Karan Mosque, where there is a well. And they even think maybe this 12th Imam that's going to come back and reappear is going to come right up out of that well. And immediately after getting elected, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad dedicated $17 million to that mosque. He must be a believer in it. That's about what we're going to pay for the auditorium. And he dedicated that money to it. And so Satan knows how to get people's attention focused because he follows the pattern that God uses. And that had to be pretty impressive to a lot of people. But he has said, Ahmadinejad has said, that the main mission of the Islamic Revolution was to pave the way for the coming of the 12th Imam. That's the main mission the Islamic Revolution has. Now, he's shown they're investing money in that, and he believes it. And he's different than anybody that has ever had a nuclear bomb before. He believes if you have some great catastrophe, that's going to hasten the return of the 12th Imam, and that's just delightful to them. Now, this is a hate-filled, genocidal maniac that's about to get a nuclear bomb and spread it around to his terrorist proxies. And this is the world in which we live, and the world that Christ told us that we'd be living in almost 2,000 years ago. And last week, Ahmadinejad launched a satellite as he continues to refine his missiles to carry those nuclear warheads. This is about as serious as anything you can imagine. Far worse than the financial disaster that we hear so much about. And they can even fire missiles. He can even fire missiles now. I think it's in the Shahab rocket that will reach Europe. And Europe is taking note, don't you think? Don't you think Europe is listening? Notice this quote that I think I might have used before. But on December the 15th, 2005, Deutsche Welle quoted the Berlin paper TAS, encouraging Germans to take Ahmadinejad seriously for this reason. Quote, his words are falling on fertile ground in the Islamic countries and adding fuel to the hatred of the West and Israel. Then, according to Munich Daily, Süddeutsche Zeitung, as saying that Ahmadinejad's continued provocations scream for a response. That paper urged European leaders to prepare for confrontation and to make it clear to Ahmadinejad that there are consequences to his populist campaign. Well, remember, there's a man going to come on the scene with a fierce countenance, and he's going to take on Ahmadinejad, and then it's going to really get interesting. I watched a program, just part of a program one night, and it was fascinating over in Israel. It actually was made in Britain, and they were talking about the sun. I mean, you just can't even fathom all the power there is in the sun. I think we can understand it somewhat, but it's just hard to even imagine all that energy. And they said, I believe it, that I got this right, that they just have little explosions on the sun all the time, which is over 90% hydrogen. And you can begin to kind of see what this hydrogen bomb is all about when you understand that. But just one little explosion on the sun, just a small one, they showed the size of it, would provide enough energy for the earth for a million years, all the energy we use today, for a million years. Just one little explosion on the sun. Of course, we know if the sun were a little further away, we'd freeze to death. If we're a little closer, we'd burn up. That's just one body out there that God created. And you know, it's really what they're trying to duplicate and are duplicating with the hydrogen bomb, creating their own little sun, releasing all that energy of God to try to blow each other off the map. Something is terribly wrong with man. Now, that's just a little tiny portion of the creation of God. And those men that get in and study it, they study that. The scholars study it. The intellectuals study it. And God says in Romans 1, they are just in awe of God's creation, so much so that they put it above the Creator. Crazy, but that's what they do. They don't really see the Creator of all that, but they're just mesmerized by the creation. And God says they just became fools in their reasoning. The sun has over 90% hydrogen, which it converts to helium. So men want to kind of recreate that on this earth and recreate that sun and just obliterate human life and solve the problems of the world, they think. But you know, I did think about that a little bit, brethren. We do have a work to do, and it does take faith. And we need to get this job done. We do need to understand that breathtaking creation of God. It is just, I mean, if you just study one little portion of it, it just about leaves you breathless. And it has to do with faith. I thought it was interesting that what it says over in Matthew 8, let's look at that, since we have to do this work, and we have to walk by faith to go through those open doors, or the open door. Matthew 8, verse 5. This is really a fascinating few verses here. And I think verses that we haven't fully understood like we should. And I think that we all need to understand it better, and I include myself. Verse 5, and when Jesus was entered into Capernaum, there came unto him a certain centurion beseeching him. This is that wealthy area, whether they were really the best education. And it was an area, frankly, brethren, very much like where we went for one of those conferences. And I'll mention more about that later if I have time. But verse 6 says, it's saying, Lord, my servant lies at home sick of the palsy, grievously tormented. Now this is that hated centurion, Roman centurion. Verse 7, and Jesus said unto him, I will come and heal him. The centurion answered and said, Lord, I am not worthy that you should come under my roof. But speak the word only, and my servant shall be healed. I mean, what is that, faith or what? Verse 9, for I am a man under authority, having soldiers under me, and I say to this man, go, and he goes, and to another, come, and he comes, and to my servant, do this, and he does it. And when Jesus heard it, he marveled and said to them that followed, verily I say unto you, I have not found so great faith, no, not in Israel. Well, now we need that faith. We need this kind of faith. Here was this centurion. He said, look, I have all these 100 soldiers under me, and I tell them to do this and do that and do this and do that, and they do it because I'm in control. I'm in authority over those men, and they do what I say. And here you are, the creator of this vast universe. Maybe this man was into studying that subject. I'm not sure. But he says, look, you're over all this creation, and when you say something, it has to be done. You're an authority. You're the government. You rule. It has to be. It has to happen, just like you say. And God, and Christ just marveled. He said, well, I have never seen faith like that in all of Israel. Never. Well, now he's talking about the faith to be healed. It's also the faith to walk through an open door. How great is our Creator God? How great He is. And I, verse 11, and I say unto you that many shall come from the east and the west and shall sit down with Abraham and Isaac and Jacob in the kingdom of heaven, but the children of the kingdom shall be cast out into outer darkness. There shall be weeping and gnashing of teeth. And Jesus said unto the centurion, go your way, and as you have believed, so be it done unto you. And his servant was healed in the selfsame hour. Exactly when God commanded it, he was healed. Just like the rule the centurion had over his regiment or whatever he ruled, whatever they called it. But I think this is one of the great examples of faith in all the Bible. And brethren, we need this kind of faith. We need to really know God. We need to know God and all the vast power He has. I mean, it's just nothing. It's just nothing for Him to heal somebody. And if we have the faith and He says do it, it's going to happen just like that. So quickly. If we have this kind of faith, if He opens a door and we follow Christ through it, it's going to happen just immediately. That is, the work is going to really begin to take off immediately if we walk through that door. But this ought to have been embarrassing to Israel to have this man who was maybe somewhat of an astronomer himself right there in the midst of Capernaum, where they had all this wealth and all this education and no faith. They got so wrapped up in all of the resort areas and the fun and the pleasures and false education and lost all their faith if they ever had any. That's what happened. And Christ marveled that this man had such faith. The Son of God marveled, just marveled, that there was such faith in this person. Can you imagine that? Why was he so moved? Well, I just read the verses to you. Is he going to open doors for us to proclaim to Judah, the cities of Judah, behold your God? In spite of Ahmadinejad, in spite of the Holy Roman Empire, behold your God. He's coming. And all of this trouble you see around you, it really causes them anxiety. It's all going to disappear forever. It is not going to be an easy job to say to the cities of Judah, behold your God. And it's going to imply a lot of things they don't want to hear, or maybe say it directly. But God controls the universe. God created the sun, all that power that's being released in hydrogen bombs, where you can just drop it in a city and no inhabitants are left, not one person left in the city, like Dallas or New York City or Washington, D.C. Isn't that an amazing accomplishment for men? Isn't that something to behold and to spend sleepless nights about? I think so. You know, that's what Paul said. You men that go out there and study the creation, and from that creation you can just see the invisible so powerfully. And they didn't see it. They didn't want to see it. They wanted to sort of be vain and play their own little, have their own little God complex, I suppose. But the centurion wasn't that way. He studied that, and he knew behind that, all of that creation was an oh-so-mighty, all-powerful God that could do anything and would do anything if we just trust Him. Anything that we need. Anything. He loves to use His power, but He wants us to trust Him and to have faith. Iran has huge piles of uranium, like a half a ton. And now they're perfecting the ballistic missiles to deliver the nuclear warheads. And there's just no doubt, brethren, there's just no doubt. You can even look at this from other directions and see it's going to happen. There's just no doubt in the minds of the experts over there that the terrorists are going to get nuclear power. They're going to get nuclear devices, but there's one big difference today that we never did see before. They're mad, and they have nuclear bombs. I mean, the experts at one of the conferences said, look, he believes that they will have a crude nuclear bomb this year, in 2009. And they say, the authorities said it a maximum of 2 years before their bomb is developed, and yet nobody has done anything about it. And I don't think they probably will. A man by the name of Isaac Ben Israel said, well, he was one of the government officials over there, and he says, no sane world will allow Iran to arm with nuclear bombs. No sane world would even allow that. Sometimes we're not so sane. A.Q. Khan had to help to develop the Pakistani nuclear bomb, the first Muslim bomb, I guess we could say. And they said that he had to have complicity with the intelligence or with the army or with somebody to be able to do that. And then, of course, after he did build the Pakistani bomb, then he began to freelance and just get all the parts and the technology and all of the material that was needed so they could just have one-stop shopping for nuclear bombs. And that's what he was doing. And finally, we tracked him down and caught up with him, and they made him stop and put him under house arrest. But yesterday, they released him. What is happening? Did he get out so he can help Iran complete their nuclear bomb? It's just like a little sun that's going to explode and destroy human beings, all human beings in a city where there is absolutely no inhabitant left. And this is what we're facing, and it's about to happen. And it's just like Christ said it would happen so long ago. But who believes Christ? Or who believes Jeremiah? Or who believes Isaiah? Even though they talk about how religious they are, they just got to be religious. They've got to get back to religion. But that's not the religion of Jeremiah. That's just talk. We give them the religion of Jeremiah. We give them the religion of God. And that can get you in trouble. In the past, Remember MAD, M-A-D? Well, we'll put another slant on that, I guess, now. Another kind of MAD. But that meant when the, like, mutually assured destruction. So let's say if Russia knew they could destroy us with their nuclear power, but they realized, well, if we do destroy them, they're also going to destroy us. So they'd back off. That's common sense, isn't it? Well, there's no point in us destroying them if they're going to destroy us too. So they'd back off. But let me tell you, that thinking won't stop Ahmadinejad. He relishes that thought. Hey, that's just going to hasten the coming of my imam. And you can't think about nuclear bombs the way you used to because you've got a madman who has nuclear power or is about to have it and has all these terrorist proxies that are out there gunning for him. And they've never had anybody on this earth before that nutty and insane that will get the bomb. But he's gotten it virtually. And he's going to trigger and push and push and push till we have World War III triggered. He's going to be excited about all that. And the Jews are nervous. That is their number one concern. It should be. Should be ours too. The Jews today are facing their worst water crisis ever. The last 5 years have had drought. The beautiful Sea of Galilee is pretty low. And I think they even share that water with others. Probably not for long. And they have a pretty serious unemployment problem. That's the main reason that the City of David Dig has been stopped. And they have these Iranian terrorists all around them, just about to surround them. And you know what their thinking is. You know what it is. Maybe I can just quickly read Matthew 24 and verse 21. We certainly know about it, but I thought I'd like to read to you again how this is introduced in Matthew. For then shall be great tribulation, such as was not since the beginning of the world to this time, no, nor ever shall be. And except those days should be shortened, there's the behold your God, there should no flesh be saved alive, Moffat says, but for the elect's sake those days shall be shortened. What terror! And God warned us. But notice what happens when God really usually warns through his prophets. Matthew 23 and verse 29. Woe unto you scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, because you build the tombs of the prophets and garnish the sepulchres of the righteous. I mean, they can spend thousands and thousands of dollars and maybe find some artifacts from the time of Jeremiah, and they'll polish it and they'll put it in on display and they'll write about it, and they'll just, oh, well, you just think, well, wow, these are religious people. These people really are followers of God in an amazing way. But it doesn't quite register with them and with the rest of Israel, not just Judah, but all of the countries of Israel. What really did happen to Jeremiah himself when he proclaimed the message? He almost died in Jerusalem. And he would have died if God hadn't saved him, because he proclaimed the message I'm talking to you about now. Only it wasn't quite as scary then. And then, oh yes, they also killed the Son of God. Killed the Son of God. How evil is that? Well, notice verse 31. Wherefore you be witnesses unto yourselves that you are the children of them which killed the prophets. Yeah, just same old, no change. Fill you up then the measure of your fathers, you serpents, you generation of vipers. How can you escape the damnation of hell? Well, that certainly must have offended a few people. You serpents, you snakes. Well, Jesus Christ really had a strong message for them. It took a lot of faith to deliver that message and go through what he went through. And he said, here's what he said in verse 34, "Wherefore, behold, I send unto you prophets and wise men and scribes, and some of them you shall kill and crucify, and some of them shall you scourge in your synagogues and persecute them from city to city." They just have to run from city to city to keep you from killing them. And he says there, I send them, this great, all-powerful, almighty God, I send them. And this is what you do to them. You people that just polish up your little artifacts and your tombs and all of that, but you won't listen to what those prophets said. Isn't that amazing? I guess they're most famous for doing just that. And this is talking about what happened in the Old Testament. There is certainly our Bible and the church and the Jews' Bible. Verse 36, "Verily I say unto you, all these things shall come upon this generation." And it's coming. "O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, you that kill the prophets and stone them which are sent unto you, how often would I have gathered your children together, even as a hen gathers her chickens under her wings, and you would not. Behold, your house is left unto you desolate. But there's good news, for I say unto you, you shall not see me henceforth till you say, blessed is he that comes in the name of the Lord." Blessed. Is anybody, they're going to change their whole attitude. If anybody comes in the name of the Lord and they start talking to you about Jeremiah and Isaiah and Ezekiel and the very word of God, people are going to say, "Oh, you're so blessed to be able to hear that. What a change in this world. What a change is about to occur in this world." All of the nuclear bombs, the biological weapons, and the chemical weapons, and all of that is going to be gone. And people are going to love hearing God's messenger. They're going to love it. You can read this. I don't think I'll have time to get into this, but you can read it. Hosea 5 and verse 13, where it talks about that wound that Judah has. None of the Arabs really recognized Israel as a state. And they had the Oslo Peace Accord that started in 1993. And just look, and they're still trying to negotiate peace and stay within that framework. And look at the fruits of that. Now God says it's a wound. It's a wound. This is their Bible. This is the Bible we all ought to look to. And it's a wound. Because they don't trust God like they should. They don't put their faith in God like they should. Nor does anybody else, the Christians or anybody else. They don't trust God. They don't believe Hosea. They kill people like Hosea. Or they scourge them, or they run them out of town. Don't listen to that. Even though you've got all these years to see it, well, see that it's the fruits of it. Don't say that. But you know something? They finally do see that they have the wound. They finally see it. And then where do they go? To Assyria. That's not a good decision. Not a good decision. And yet, brethren, we see people in this world, and all religious people talk about their Bible and their Torah and all of that, maybe being the very basis of their whole existence. But is it true? Is it true? Well, all you have to do is a little studying, and you're going to see there's some real problems there. Just a little study of the Bible. What we study here in Armstrong College all the time, trying to build in our young people this understanding. This understanding that they're going to have, or they're not going to stick around. They're not going to stay with God. I mean, you look at the church and say, well, hey, I don't like that church. I want to be in a church where there's a lot of fun. Or whatever. Do you see why you're in the church? I mean, it's going to be fun for all eternity. But it's not fun all the time now. Not at all. Do you know why you're here? You know why you're a part of this church? You know why we exist? You know why this church exists? Why the house for God is being built? Do we know why? Of all those conferences, I heard only one vague prophecy. And they, of course, have religious leaders there, and the like. And I'm not just aiming this at the Jews, because it applies to all religions. But what happens, brethren, if you blot out the prophecies of God? Well, then you blot out the coming of the Messiah. You blot that out too, and there's no hope. And that's where they are headed now. It even says in Jeremiah, some of them even now don't have hope, but they just go on the same way. Well, I'll get out of it while I can, but there's no hope if we blot out prophecy. No hope at all. Well, I'm going to have to move along here. While all that noise is being made over in the Middle East, a lot is happening in Europe. Here's what Stratford wrote. There are two very telling things about this weekend's deal that reveal the future of Ukraine and Russia's relations with Europe. This was written January 19th. First, as Stratford saw while following the negotiations, it was never about the big public summits involving the Russian and Ukrainian presidents and the EU, but the behind-the-scenes deals being struck by the real power brokers, Putin, Tymoshenko, and German Chancellor Angela Merkel. And January 16th, Putin left for, this is January 16th again, I thought that was just interesting. January 16th, Putin left for a two-day meeting with Merkel and then returned to Moscow, where he met with Tymoshenko, with a deal struck soon after, Tymoshenko being the ruler of Ukraine. The players and their true roles as power brokers are important, for they are the only ones who really understand and are willing to commit to what needed to be done in order to get the natural gas flowing again, which Russia cut off, because return Ukraine to the Russian fold. Oh, yes, we will continue to give you your gas, but, oh, by the way, we don't want the Ukraine going into NATO. In fact, we want it to stay in the Russian fold. It all, they were wheeling and dealing, was going on January the 16th as we enter into the times of the Gentiles. It says, first, Germany represented Europe in negotiations between Russia and the continent and was central in solving this crisis, in spite of what the others thought. Second, Russia is turning the gas back on because Germany and ultimately Europe appears to have agreed to allow the Kremlin to work a program designed to return Ukraine to the Russian fold. Third, the deal between Russia and Germany was struck on January 16th, a significant date not lost on longtime trumpet readers. It says here, but many have received their warning from Russia, which has shown it is willing to do more than tinker with energy supplies. The latest deal between Russia and Germany clearly shows that Berlin is emerging as the mouthpiece of Europe. Well, now that's a shocker, isn't it? Does that shock you? Does that shock any of us? No, Berlin's doing the speaking. We're entered into the times of the Gentiles. Last week, America was notified, I think it was just last week, that they would lose the base in Kyrgyzstan, which is also, being one of the old Soviet satellites or states of the Soviet Empire, Soviet Union, and they're being brought back into the fold. Remember, Putin said that the greatest crisis of the 20th century was the breakup of the Soviet Union. I tell you, he's going to get it back. See, this is the times of the Gentiles, the times of Israel, no more. Forget about that. We're about to fall totally apart. And even Rupert Murdoch said, if they don't do something quickly about the economy, there's going to be total disaster. You remember Angela Merkel stood up to, well, really had a message quite different than what the Pope delivers when she talked to the Jews in Jerusalem, and even visited Yad Vashem, the Holocaust Museum and said that the Germans were filled with shame because of that, though most news reporters said a lot of Germans don't agree with that. So it's obviously going to affect her political career, but she's quite a powerful lady and quite a, I think, in many ways, a great leader. I'll just try to paraphrase this if I can, but you know what the Pope did, reinstate this one bishop that doesn't even believe in the Holocaust, or at least for the most part, he doesn't believe in it. And so he's reinstated into his office, and he started talking right away about how he wasn't, or he didn't believe all of that. And I mean, it caused quite an uproar in the world, and even in Germany. And Angela Merkel spoke out against it herself. Said that this is not right. And I don't believe the Pope is going to like that, but he did end up changing his decision and made that man say, well, if you don't admit these things, then you're not going to be in the Catholic Church ministry. But I'll tell you, it's causing quite an uproar. But what is it going to do to Angela Merkel? What is it going to do to her career, do you think? It says here, this is from the Spiegel Online, the Vatican is horrified by the discussion. Bernd Bosselt of the Christian Social Union, the CSU, the Bavarian sister party to Merkel's CDU, warned the chancellor against posing as a Pope's taskmaster. Well, it's not your job to go around correcting the Pope. Well, you can see it's causing her some difficulties. President of the German Parliament, Norbert Lammert, said that much of what the Pope has been accused of is malicious and certainly not fair. Rhetorical contest that it is neither reasonable nor helpful. Well, I would disagree with that. But you can see how that could damage the political career of Angela Merkel. And remember, they're going to have an election on September the 28th. I think I have that date right, and that happens to be on the Day of Atonement. So it might be an interesting date to watch. What is going to happen in the German election? Do you think maybe we might see our Daniel 8 man come on the scene at that time? I might mention also that I do want to go to you. I'm going to Europe in less than 3 weeks, because we did get, if everything holds, we did get our meeting with a member of parliament over in Britain. And I will be going alone on that trip, because, well, two long trips for my son and Andrew Loker are just too much for them. They are getting older, you know. Well, actually, I was really, really well pleased with them. When we were at this bar mitzvah, they got out there doing the famous Israeli dance. I thought, man, that's really getting in the spirit. I think that impressed even the Jews. Well, that's a way to get in solid with the Jews, I guess. Or certainly improve your relations with them. Well, anyhow, with the problems continue in Britain and America, and I'd like to go over there and hope that would have something to do maybe with opening up, by meeting with this member of parliament, opening up a few things for us in Britain, and we'll see. But we do have a crew over there, a TV crew, and everything we need if we're allowed to videotape that. But a lot of terrible things are happening in Britain and America. And I mean, we're going down fast. Britain may even be in worse shape than we are. And here in the U.S., it says here in this article, record 19 million U.S. homes stood vacant in 2008. 19 million. It's It's like we'd never have to build another house forever. Well, Shimon Peres says, pessimism is now the rage there. The rage in Davos, Switzerland. Everybody is very, very pessimistic. All of these people that we were in the midst of were some of the most educated people in this world. Almost all of them, well known. Or many of them, anyhow, well known. And we're going to have to deal with people like that in the future. And how are we going to do that, brethren, to get this message out? How are we going to deal with them? How are we going to approach them? How are we going to get the job done for Christ? And if He opens the door, well, we don't have a choice. We have to just go through it. If He opens the door. Notice, I believe I've got this right, Matthew 13. No, I believe it's Matthew 11. Let's see, just a minute. I can't quite read what it says here. Yes, Matthew 11 in verse 18. Will we start? Well, let's see. Yeah, let's read verse 18. For John came neither eating or drinking, and they say he has a demon. And the Son of Man comes eating and drinking. They say, behold, a man gluttonous and a wine bibber and a friend of publicans and sinners, but wisdom is justified over children. Now this is Capernaum again. This resort area with all the educated people. Verse 20, then began to upbraid the cities wherein most of the mighty works were done because they repented not. Woe unto you, Chorazin! Woe unto you, Bethsaida! For if the mighty works which were done in you had been done in Tyre and Sidon, they would have repented long ago in sackcloth and ashes. But I say unto you, it shall be more tolerable for Tyre and Sidon in the day of judgment than for you. And you, Capernaum, which are exalted into heaven, shall be brought down to Hades. For if the mighty works which had been done in you had been done in Sodom, it would have remained until this day. For I say unto you that it shall be more tolerable for the land of Sodom in the day of judgment than for you. Verse 25, and at that time Jesus answered and said, I thank you, O Father, Lord of heaven and earth, because you have hid these things from the wise and prudent and have revealed them unto babes. Revealed them unto babes. Christ did all of those mighty works, and people were not impressed. Human nature was not impressed. And especially in these cities like Capernaum, where they had, oh, so much wealth and so much of a nice resort area and all these great educated intellectuals. How are we going to deal with those people? Well, brethren, we're going to have to go before God, this great Creator God, and be like a little child, a little babe, and ask God for all the correction that we need to straighten out our lives and be able to do this work. He's revealed it unto babes. Here we have all of this knowledge and all of this understanding that's just so magnificent because we allow God to reveal it to us. And it's just earth-shaking. The centurion was like this before God. He was like this. The great Creator God. I'm nothing. I'm not even fit for you to come into my home. I'm not even fit to sit in your church. But thank you, God, that I can be a part of all of this. You want to know what hope is ahead for those people over there? What hope they heard? What solutions they heard? Let me give you just the main solutions in concluding this. I mean, these were the outstanding speakers, the best ones there. And here was one of the solutions. Thomas Friedman of the New York Times talked about imagination, like America is some kind of a dream factory, and they have this great imagination. And he says, what you imagine really matters. Well, does it, brethren? Does it really matter what we imagine if God is cursing us? Does it matter? What do you mean your imagination can solve all these problems? What kind of reasoning is that? And it's no wonder that man is so filled with our problems and fears and so on. God says we ought to cast down those imaginations or those reasonings. That isn't going to solve our problems. They're still groping in the dark, saying, well, I believe this will do it. What nonsense. What foolishness. Well, several speakers touted education as the solution. But education is not the solution. Education is the problem. That's the problem. That's what Christ was talking about. Matthew 13, verse 15 says they've closed their mind to God. These intellectuals, these great men that get out there and study the sun and just teach such a marvelous lesson about the sun, but don't even have anything to say about the Creator of the sun. What kind of foolishness is that? Is that going to solve our problems? The U.K., which we tried to work it out where we could visit them on this trip, but we couldn't do it. They've lost their empire already, but they haven't lost their media empire. BBC is very strong out there in this world, polluting the news every week. And it's so radically liberal, it's hard to believe. And they've even established a station over here in America just for homosexuals. I believe they're the authors of that. And of course, they have Sky News, which is world all over the world. They still have their educational empire, Cambridge and Oxford. Oxford, which still is one of the most exalted universities around. And they fought Winston Churchill in the 1930s as he warned his nation, perhaps more than any university in the world. And didn't find anything there to repent of, though. They just go right on with their education. Won't even listen to their own great leaders. That was proven right. Oh yes, and they have a religious empire still. The Anglican Church is still quite powerful and was probably one of the first Protestant churches for their leader to go before the Pope and kiss his ring. Even though he sits there in a country where the very throne of God is. The very throne of David that Christ is going to sit on. And he goes and he kisses the Pope's ring. And that fills God with wrath. And it should. What kind of religion is that? Are these people seeking the truth? There were over 100,000 demonstrators in London saying, we are Hamas. And they had a lot of the intelligentsia there helping them. And not any of the universities condemned that, according to Melanie Phillips. They did nothing. Well, you heard us condemning it. You saw that we were writing against it. You saw that we had something to say about that. What are these universities doing? Why is their education so good? They're not doing anything. They're not speaking out against evil. They're proliferating it. Those educators over there and here think the UN is the epitome of goodness. The BBC was quoted as saying, peace is made by talking to your enemies. Brethren of God, I'll tell you this. You could sit and talk to Ahmadinejad and those terrorists for 10 trillion years if they lived that long and they'd never, ever, ever change their minds. The only way you'll ever have peace with them is to kill them if you'll excuse my language. That's just the way they're constituted in Satan's world. And if we trusted God, we wouldn't have that problem to deal with. We wouldn't even have that to deal with. But you know what is really wonderful? Here we have Imperial School and Armstrong College. This is the education they ought to be looking to, the education of tomorrow. I mean, it's right here. The solution and the hope that they're looking for and trying, they come up with these foolish, idiotic ideas that if even they stop to think about, they'd know it was stupid to say this is their hope. How wonderful that God has revealed this to us. How wonderful that God has given us all this. How blessed are the people of God. Professor Yuri Azad said that Dr. Mazar's archaeology takes us to the very root of our civilization and history. There's no such city in the world. And I thought, wow, if he only understood the future of Jerusalem, if he only understood, as we understand, about what this all means and what the dig is all about and what it really does reveal. It's an added dimension that just overwhelms you because it's so wonderful. Because it is so wonderful. What a dimension to be added to God's people. Then he said only Rome might come close to comparing with Jerusalem. Because they have their city built on hills as well. You can see the counterfeit there, I think. If you understood the truth, and even of Isaiah 14 and Ezekiel 28, you'd know how terribly wrong that is. I mean, one's at one end of the spectrum and one is at the other. I mean, they're just total opposites. And I thought about you young people when I heard one of them say, 50% of the soldiers that go into the armies, that's men and women over there, are ignorant of their country's own history. They're ignorant of it. Of their country's own history, and they don't want to die. They're young. They don't want to die for their country. They want to have fun. And they make terrible soldiers when they don't understand their own history. And really the same thing applies spiritually, but they need to know. You see, they need to know about what Dr. Mazar has found and really understand it about the history of David and Nehemiah and Jeremiah. And all these great men of the Bible, they need to know, well, what does that all mean? What did they have to do with our history? But they don't even learn it. I wonder if our young people are learning the history of this church. The history of God's Elijah. And the history of Jesus Christ himself establishing this very church. And all the way back to Adam and Eve when they left, caused mankind to turn away from God. How much do young people understand? We've had some young people leave this church. How much do you understand that you're going to miss out on the opportunity of opportunities of opportunities if you miss out on this? It's worth fighting for. And it's the only thing worth living for is this. That's all. Well, let me give you a couple more solutions and I'll conclude. Carolyn Glick, marvelous writer for the Jerusalem Post. And we did see Mr. Dory Gold while we were over there, got to say hello anyhow. And she and he, Dory Gold, were going to be speaking with Mr. Netanyahu the following night. So she's probably going to end up in politics. Very impressive lady. You know what her solution was? She said, look to the people and have hope in them and you'll be fine. Wow. What if Winston Churchill had done that? There wouldn't be a Britain today. If God had let things go on, look to the people. What are you talking about? What is leadership? You mean the people don't need leadership?
What kind of a solution is that? What kind of hope is that? These are educated people, and this is their hope. There is no hope in that, and they have to know that there isn't. If they stop and think about it the way they think about other issues. Melanie Phillips, also one of the great writers, the greatest writer, I think, in Britain. And she says she thinks there may be hope and there's more people might be listening and heeding what we're saying than we realize. Well, that's no hope either. It's not really true, probably, and except, well, maybe a few exceptions. People do learn a few lessons as they go along, but that's her hope, and that's her solution. And it's pitiful. It's pitiful. We have hope. We have God opening a door, and we walk through the door, and it works. And everything He tells us happens just exactly the way He says it will. And what hope there is in that. What beauty, what joy, what excitement there is if you follow Jesus Christ. Well, I'll give you one more. Bernard Lewis, probably the greatest expert in the Middle East, on the Middle East. He's written many books, an ex-professor. And he says his solution is he thinks there might be some Gentiles out there, some Arabs, watching this democratic way of life and get inspired by it and decide they want to be a part of that. And they might stir up their countries to do that, even though our democracies are mired in moral depravity and filth. And they're cursed by God because of their evil and have no will to stand up and fight. God would give us will, whether it's on the physical level or the spiritual level. He'll give us the will to fight when we have to fight and to win. But if He won't do it if we don't see Him as this great Creator with all that power to give us where we can do anything. Anything that is lawful and godly. Our democracies are collapsing. You think that's going to get people stirred up? No, that isn't going to get them stirred up. You can read Psalm 137, verses 5 and 6, where David said, "Let me lose the fighting ability of my right hand, and let my tongue cleave to my mouth, if Jerusalem above, or if Jerusalem is not above my chief joy." If Jerusalem's not above my chief joy, let that happen to me, God. That's quite a profound statement. He was dedicated to Jerusalem. Thank God he was, because it's his throne, called his throne. It's really God's throne, but it's called the throne of David on this earth. That's quite an honor. And it's no wonder God gave him that honor. An honor forever in Jerusalem. Wonder what David would think about the dig. Wonder what David would think about all that. One of the speakers said, "Well, look, we can't rely just on miracles," and I think I know what he means. You have to fight, and that's true. But really, brethren, it's all about miracles for us. Even our fighting has to be connected to miracles. There have to be miracles from this awesome, almighty, all-powerful God. There must be miracles in everything we do. And there is. What kind of a country is it that will let terrorists lob missiles into their country for 8 years and let them get away with it? Ashkelon, I believe they said, had something like 240 missiles fired into their city or in that environment or their environs last year. What kind of a country would let another country fire missiles into their own land and not go out and destroy them? David would have killed them all. What kind of weakness is that? Is that a good life? Doesn't strike me as being a good life. I don't think it's a good life. One of the biggest events of 2009 was Hezbollah's takeover of Lebanon. And 2009, really, the King of the South is already, I believe, or the one is the one that has mainly swung Turkey away from their alliance with Judah. Already this year, there's been another war in Gaza. And the Hamas wasn't defeated. They even fight to a standstill. They're the winner because they're going to get stronger. But what occurs to me is, brethren, what has happened? What is happening in this end time so fast that, I mean, just in a year, you see these enormous changes on the world scene. You wait. This is February the 7th. You check your calendar next year and see what happened between February 7th this year to February the 7th next year. And I think you will be shocked. Certainly, a lot of people in this world are going to be shocked. We're going to be amazed, and I think certainly impressed by it. But we have to keep pace with all of these prophecies that are being fulfilled. We've got to know how to deal with the people in this world. And the Jews have this Negev desert, and it is like their new frontier. And I think it's good thinking that they have. But they tried to go out there and invest in it and make it blossom as a rose. And they have done a lot of that in Israel. But they can't very well get things going in the Negev, because when they get started, they'll have another war. Or if they get into it, there's a drought. Or if they start again, they'll lose their funding. Or maybe another war. And so much of the wealth in Judah has come from this nation, the birthright nation that really has all of this wealth because of Abraham's obedience. Now, they don't know that, but they want to make the Negev blossom like a rose. And God says, brethren, that that's what we've been called to do. To make the Negev and all the deserts and all the barren places on this earth blossom like a rose, even on out into the universe. Make it just blossom all over the whole universe. Behold your God. That's what the plan is. I just got a little glimpse of a beautiful sunset over the Mediterranean. Now, though, what a wonderful sunset, what a wonderful vision that is for someone who knows God, to see all that fabulous beauty, and yet you couldn't help but be struck by the fact that the sun is setting on Judah and America and Britain. The sun is setting. But thank God there's about to be a dawn when all of these wonderful prophecies are going to be fulfilled, and we're going to be able to help God establish a civilization that's going to bring happiness and joy and abundance forever and ever and ever. And that's something that's truly thrilling to be a part of.